The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back to the Paranorm Girl podcast. I am your host, Kristen. Today we wrap up our exploration this season of all four of the Horsemen of Sasquatchery, and I couldn't think of a better guest to help me do so, who also themselves has played an impactful role in the ongoing search for logical answers, truth, and science. She has helped to make numerous mysteries make sense for thousands of people with her chart-topping podcast and subsequent book series. I will introduce her following just a few announcements, April 26th, 27th, and 28th, if you live in or around the Tombstone area, or you have plans to be there for any reason, really. Stop into my booth at the second annual Tombstone Wild West Paracon and say hi. Don't be a stranger now. I will be selling some of my merch. I've got some t-shirts, sweatshirts, and caps I'll be slinging. But I will also be offering a story time booth to anyone willing to sit and chat with me. Tell me your story. Talk paranormal to me. Whatever spooky discussion or soliloquy your heart desires, I'm there for it. I absolutely cannot wait for this event, but seriously, cannot wait to meet more of my paranormal brethren. This past Saturday, Beer, Booze, and Boogeymen went live with our third episode, Spooky AI and Haunted Electronics. We also welcomed special guest Interscare Sleep onto the panel. If you are like me, and you love falling asleep to scary stories told in a melodic and soothing voice, Interscare Sleep is a YouTube channel you must immediately go subscribe to. You're gonna want to. I hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Gil, Joey, Damien, and I certainly enjoyed doing the show. If I have any new ears on today's show and you have no idea what I am talking about, Beer, Booze, and Boogeymen goes live the first Saturday of every month. Thus far, we have discussed our experiences, told listener stories, and welcomed live callers to tell their personal experiences with things like workplace hauntings, strange lights and encounters, spooky AI and haunted electronics, most recently, and May 4th. Anyone planning to tune in can look forward to an awesome episode. We will be covering communications from the other side. I have a feeling this one is going to be a busy one. I know a lot of folks have these kinds of experiences. I know I do. So here are the deets for that upcoming program. The title for our fourth episode is Last Visit, Loved Ones Who Come Back for One More Goodbye. Now, this can include family, friends, and our sweet little fur babies. You can catch it live on the Paranorm Girl Pod YouTube channel May 4th at 4:30 p.m. Pacific. You can submit your story early to be read or played if you choose to leave us a voice message at ghost.beer or call in during the live stream at 208-717-1611. That is all I have for announcements right now. Let's get into it. Today's very special guest is a seasoned journalist, editor, producer, and author. She spent a decade with NPR, is a founding partner of the multimedia company Foxtopus Inc., and is the host of the critically acclaimed podcast Wild Thing. Her show is an intelligent, funny, and incredibly thorough quest for answers that initially began with Sasquatch. And her quest for Sasquatch initially began with a surprise discovery that it kind of runs in the family. Please enjoy my conversation with Laura Krantz. My guest is Laura Krantz. I am so thrilled to have you here. Thank you so much, Laura.
Well, thank you for having me on.
It's been something I've really been looking forward to, just to get to talk to you. I in our previous emails, I told you that, you know, I was going to dedicate an episode specifically to Grover. I live in Pullman, Washington. I don't know if I told you that before. I'm about a 5-minute walk from WSU.
Nice.
And there's not much of him there anymore. I originally thought there was a exhibit, like a Bigfoot exhibit. I was like, oh, I'm going to go up there and take a look. See, no, it's not there anymore.
I think everything he had, I'm assuming the Bigfoot exhibit would have been related to his stuff, and everything he has is at the Smithsonian. So but there's a lot of Bigfoot in that part of the world. I went to school in Walla Walla. Down the road from you, and there's all kinds of reports and sightings and things that have been written about that part of the country. So,
one of these days, somebody is going to let me go on a Bigfoot expedition with them. And I got Colville Forest just up north. I got the Blue Mountains just down south. It's bound to happen. I'm so sorry. Let's get this started. So since you are new to my show, maybe not to my audience, but new to my show, new to some of my listeners, would you mind just giving us a brief introduction to Laura Krantz?
Yeah, well, your intro was pretty thorough as it was, but I've been a journalist now for closing in on almost 20 years. I worked at NPR for 10 years as a producer and an editor, kind of working on a variety of topics, but I was always most interested in sort of science and environmental topics. And when I left NPR, I was kind of thinking, okay, what do I want to do next? I tried magazine writing for a little bit, and I realized that I just like audio better. I like it better as a medium. I like hearing people's voices. I like telling stories using words that way and on audio. So I decided to tackle an interesting project that had probably fallen into my lap about a decade prior. I'd been living and working in Washington, D.C. And in the newspaper one morning, there was this big article about a guy named Grover Krantz, who was an anthropologist, a tenured professor at Washington State, and a scientist and the country's preeminent academic expert on Bigfoot. And I was like, can you be both a scientist and be out looking for Bigfoot? How is that possible? And I sort of sat on this story for a while. The reason the article had been in the Washington Post is Grover had just donated his bones and the bones of his dogs to the Smithsonian, and they were going to be going on display as part of an exhibit about forensic anthropology. So I actually got to go and meet Grover, if you will. I had not met him prior to that. But what was most interesting to me was, like, he was from the same area of the country as my grandfather's family, Salt Lake City. And after asking around, I found out that he was my grandfather's cousin, and he used to show up at the family picnics with calipers and measure people's heads. At one point, I guess my grandfather stole a skeleton hand for Grover from the anatomy lab at the University of Utah Medical School and gave it to Grover because he knew he was so fascinated in this kind of stuff. So there's this rich family history. The guy's in the Smithsonian on display. He's a scientist. He's also into Bigfoot. There's all these little threads that I'd been sort of noodling on for years. And then I found out that Grover's fourth wife lived about half an hour away from me in Colorado. And I was like, okay, this is a sign. You need to go talk to this woman and do an interview and just see if there's anything there to do something bigger. And there was. So no pun intended on the bigger part. There was something there. It's an interesting story about how this guy who is a scientist ends up searching for Bigfoot and making it basically like the rest of his life. So That was a long-winded way of explaining how I fell into this world.
No, I appreciate that. I didn't know that. So the discovery took place, you said, a decade prior to starting the show. Wow. Why did you sit on it for so long?
Well, part of it was because I had a job and podcasting existed, but not really. Like, it was in a really nascent form at that point. I had a full-time job. And it was more of a story I'd heard, and it was kind of a fun one to trot out at cocktail parties and be like, ha ha ha, I know this guy, or I'm related to this guy who is on display in the Smithsonian, and he believed in Bigfoot. But I didn't really know what else I wanted to do with it. And then I met my current husband, and he came from an anthropology background. He's a journalist now, but he had been getting his PhD in anthropology, so he knew who Grover was. I think that was the other thing. I didn't realize that Grover had as much cachet and as much sort of like recognition as he did in the wider world. I just thought he was sort of a kind of a random guy. And it turns out he was very well known in anthropology circles. He was kind of a joke for a lot of people, but he also was just someone that anthropologists in general had been fascinated with. Like, all of my husband's friends from grad school knew who Grover was. So that sort of started getting me thinking a little bit more about, like, oh, not only was he a scientist looking into Bigfoot, but he was a scientist that had some name recognition both prior to Bigfoot and after Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm. Well, after you started to really dip your toes into the Bigfoot water, and you did realize, like, have that realization, like, oh my gosh, he's so well-liked in both of these circles, like, so well-liked, so well-respected. Like, after you had already started that research, like, did that really surprise you? Like, was it just kind of this onslaught of, like, oh my God, he's kind of a celebrity in these worlds?
Yeah, that he was more, well, it was interesting because in the anthropology world, he was kind of seen as a joke.
Right.
Because of the Bigfoot stuff, which was too bad because a lot of the other things that he was working on in terms of human evolution and human migration patterns were actually extremely interesting. And he was, you know, in the thick of these big debates about human evolution and kind of an important figure in the discussions about this topic. But his work on Bigfoot diminished how people saw him in terms of the rest of his anthropology work, which is too bad. In terms of Bigfoot, that was shocking to me, how many people knew who he was and how important he was. I remember going to a Bigfoot conference in Oregon. It must have been 2017. And I got there and I have the same last name. So I was introduced around and people were like, Krantz, are you related to Grover? Like, one guy actually got down on his knees and was like bowed to me. And he's like, you're Bigfoot royalty. I was like, whoa.
Wow.
Intense. Some of these people had known Grover and had, you know, visited with him and shared stories and ideas with him. So that was kind of cool. It was an opportunity to get to know Grover through these other people. Because like I said, I didn't really find out about Grover until after he had passed away. Mm-hmm. And I have gotten some flack for that. People are like, how could you not know who Grover was? And I was like, well, you know, do you know who your grandfather's cousins were? Like, is your family still tight and close? Like, I wasn't in the world of Bigfoot, so there's no reason I would have known who this guy was. So just would like to defend myself a little bit.
Hey, you know what? I don't understand that kind of shade. Like, I get it. I don't know anybody but my immediate family.
Right.
Totally. I think that's a lot of people's stories. But yeah, the truth is you did not get to meet him while he was still alive, but you did meet a lot of folks who knew him on a personal level. They were his students. They worked with him. What was that like picture of the person that was being painted for you?
So the people who had him as a professor, and I think this was almost across the board, loved him. He was an excellent teacher, from what I heard, gave really interesting lectures. He was very engaged with his students, especially his grad students. He would invite them over. They would hang out in the backyard. They would talk about ideas. Like, I can't think of a single graduate professor that I had when I went to grad school who invited me to their house and like wanted to bat ideas around. Like, that would have been a dream. Like, these are people who are, you know, so important and so well read in their field, and they wanted nothing to do with the students. Whereas Grover was like, yeah, let's talk, come on over. Like, he had this great rapport with the students, and everyone who took his class seemed to really enjoy it, even if they weren't necessarily going to be going into anthropology or anything like that. It sounds like many of his colleagues actually quite liked him as a human being, even if they sort of were questioning the work he was doing. I think he had some unorthodox methods about how he went about his work. There was one guy I talked to who said that at one point he was trying to figure out why some of the earlier hominins had like these sort of big, heavy brow ridges. And so Grover made one out of rubber or some sort of material and pasted it to his forehead, and then walked around campus for like 2 weeks trying to discern why this particular feature might have been valuable. I mean, not a lot of professors are going to be doing that.
Yeah.
But I don't think Grover really gave a shit, pardon my French, about what other people thought of him, which is kind of admirable. So, and then all of the people in the Bigfoot world said that he was, you know, he would listen, he was gracious. He would be inundated by people's stories about Bigfoot and what they'd seen and what they heard. And some of those stories were more grounded in science than others. I think Grover, being a scientist, was very focused on thinking about this creature as being simply a primate or a human relative that had yet to be identified. Mm-hmm. So when he would hear stories about, you know, aliens have dropped Bigfoot off, or Bigfoot travels through dimensions, or that kind of stuff, I got the sense that he was kind of good at nodding politely, but like didn't necessarily like those stories. But he at least was gracious enough to sort of let people talk.
Yeah, yeah. He just sounds just like just the coolest teacher. Like, that's mm-hmm. the teacher you want. Yeah, I really wish I had gotten the chance to meet him. I was very, very young when he passed away. But well, let's get into a little bit of your journey into the information, just a little bit, and then we're going to talk about your show and your books. I was curious from the start, what were your opinions on the Bigfoot phenomenon like before you ever started any of this, before you knew your relation?
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It was a myth. I mean, the hands down, like there, I didn't actually even really think about Bigfoot. I just thought it was kind of a joke. Where I grew up in Idaho, I think Bigfoot is more prevalent now, like in terms of something that people talk about. But like, I went camping and hiking my whole childhood and like never heard a Bigfoot story my entire life. You know, Harry and the Hendersons and the front page of the Weekly World News, if anyone remembers that, that's basically was my exposure to Bigfoot. So it was sort of like, it was just this big myth, lore, things that have been passed down for generations, but didn't actually exist.
Okay. Okay. So you begin the book and season one of Wild Thing, walking into the nest sites on the Olympic Peninsula with Shane Corson. But I was wondering, I wanted to know, as somebody else who kind of entered into this subject, kind of the same as that, like, is it a myth? All I know is from that one movie, that one time, I'd never heard a personal story either. And it was hard to begin that research. So I was just wondering, like, where did you actually start this research? Because you were doing it for a while leading up to the actual release.
Yes. So I did it about a year before the podcast came out, maybe a year and a half, because I was still working a job as I was doing some of this research too. So, you know, there's only so much time in the day.
Right.
But I really started with Grover because Grover fascinated me. It's like, again, I was really struck by the fact that this is a guy who was a scientist who was fairly well respected in his field. And then kind of is like, fuck it. I'm going to just like go into this Bigfoot thing and see where it takes me, because someone has brought me a piece of evidence that I think is indicative of the fact that Bigfoot is real. And then he continued to chase that for, let's see, that was in the 70s. He chased that for 30 more years. That's a big chunk of your life. And he was pretty sure that Bigfoot existed, but he wasn't convinced. He hadn't gotten this kind of evidence, the scientific evidence that would prove to him that Bigfoot is real. And I think many scientists might have been like, yeah, you know, it's been 30 years. I don't think it's out there. And he was sort of like continuing to look and continuing to search for this thing. So it was sort of, there was like two halves of him, this very scientifically driven half. And then this other part of him that was like, well, what if? And I think what resonated with me is I think that's inside a lot of us. Like, we come at things from a very rational perspective and we're like, it's unlikely that this is happening, but what if? And that just kind of struck me. And so I really started this whole thing with Grover and trying to understand where he was coming from. And also, you know, what evidence did he have? What did he find? Why wasn't he convinced? What did convince him? That kind of stuff.
Yeah. Did you look thoroughly at that cripple foot, like what he was saying about that specific evidence and why he was so convinced by it? Do you think his logic was misplaced with that?
You know, I saw the cast. I'm not an anthropologist. I don't know a lot about, you know, human anatomy other than where sort of generally where my organs and bones are supposed to be. So, you know, Grover's claim that he looked at the cast of that footprint and there's no way it could have been faked except by anyone who was an expert in anthropology, as much of an expert as he was. I mean, maybe. I just don't have that kind of knowledge in order to know why it convinced him. I know what he said, but for me personally, I kind of look at it and I'm like, cool. So, but it clearly resonated with him in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, have you, did you keep in touch with the guys over at Olympic Project and Shane about the nest?
I'm loosely in touch with Shane. I haven't talked to him in a while. I did hear that they had maybe found some nests elsewhere. I don't know if they've run tests on them. I think that the land that they had found, that, you know, that private timber land where those initial nests had been found, I think that has, by this point, I'm pretty sure they've probably cleared the timber on that, because I don't think they came up with a definitive answer. But yeah, I haven't really kept that much in touch. I did hear that Dr. Meldrum was not feeling well and had been ill. So I don't know how that is affecting things. You know, I'm hoping he has recovered from whatever had struck him, but, yeah, I'm a little out of the loop on the nests.
Oh, okay. All right. No, that's okay. I was just, it's a fascinating discovery, and it was really exciting to hear about, you know, the DNA analysis, and then you got the results, and I was just curious if there are any new developments. But yeah, I'd love to talk to Shane sometime. I did speak to Dr. Meldrum recently, actually.
Oh, good.
At Squatch Fest, so.
Okay.
Yeah, he seems to be doing good.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into Wild Thing and the books. So your show, Wild Thing, is absolutely just outstandingly well done. Like, it's
thank you. That's very nice of you.
There's no other way to describe it. It's just so thorough. And like, even if you're not interested in the subject, the way that you relay this information, the people that you talk to, the places that you go, you're putting boots to ground and going out in the woods and doing this stuff. Like, it's just so, I don't know, it's enthralling and it is binge worthy. The books as well, for a different reason, which I can talk about. I picked both of these guys up. the show, I found it very interesting. I have not met a lot of other folks who do it the way that you do, where you are covering very, very deeply one subject per season. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really novel approach. I like to think I do that too, just not as well as you do. But I was wondering, as someone else who attempts to do that, like at the beginning of all of this, in those early days, did you always intend to do like a serial podcast like this, going from subject to subject, season to season, or was Bigfoot only ever supposed to be a one-off?
Yeah, that's a great question. I didn't know. You know, this was the sort of thing where it's like I kind of went out on a limb and I did this project, and I had the, you know, the technical skills because of having worked at NPR for so long. Mm-hmm. I knew how to put something like this together, but I had no idea how it was going to do. For all I know, it would have been like my mom and maybe two cousins who listened to the thing, and, you know, it never would have gone anywhere. But for whatever reason, it seemed to really resonate with people. It got to like number 7 on Apple's charts at one point, which was unbelievable. I just was sort of, you know, my jaw just sort of dropped when that happened, but people really liked it. And then I was like, okay, well, let's do another season. And as a journalist, you know, I've always done sort of like general news, like, you know, one day you're working on foreign policy, the next day you're working on science, the next day you're working on, you know, some big pop culture thing. So I'd always bounce from topic to topic. And that's part of the reason that I'd gotten into journalism, because I like focusing on something for a little bit and then moving on to the next thing. So I think a lot of people were like, oh, well, you're going to do a second season on Bigfoot, right? And I was like, no, I enjoyed it for the time that I was in it. And then I was ready to kind of move on to something else. But yeah, I liked putting it together. I liked the puzzle of figuring out how do you tackle a big topic and make it, shape it in a way where people can get something out of the story, but it's not an overwhelming amount of information. It sort of gives them, it's like a 101. It's a general overview, and it gives them jumping off points to go and explore what interests them most. And so I just wanted to do that again with a different topic for season 2.
Yeah, well, and I'm glad that you said that, because you did jump from topic to topic. You jumped from Bigfoot mm-hmm. to extraterrestrial life, origins of life, which was fascinating to read about. Mm-hmm. Wasn't expecting that. And then you jumped to nuclear power and atomic yeah. energy. What's the inspiration behind
that? That one was a little bit of a stretch, but again, it sort of comes down to like, what myths do we have about science and what is actually happening with science? Oh. And these sort of tensions we have about things that have captured our imagination, or that we're scared of, or that we're horrified by, you know, just overall like fascination of some sort or another. And how does that match up with what's actually happening in the science? The nuclear one came about because I grew up in a town called Idaho Falls, and about 45 miles from that is something known as the Idaho National Laboratory. But back in the 1940s and 1950s, it was the Nuclear Research Testing Station. This is where they were building all the sort of prototypes for different types of nuclear reactors. And then they were just kind of seeing what happened. We had a very limited experience with nuclear energy. We'd only figured out how to sort of capture it starting in the 1930s. Then you get the 1940s, and we're using that for war, the Manhattan Project, essentially. And so we see the kind of devastation that it lays out during the bombing of Japan, Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And then there's this question of like, okay, we've seen what kind of destruction we can do with this energy. Can we do anything good with it? And can we sustain a nuclear reaction and control it in such a way that we can have this endless supply of power? So this is what they're trying to do out at the Idaho National Laboratory. But we don't really know what we're doing. They're blowing reactors up just to see what happens. They're sometimes blowing them up accidentally. We don't have a good sense yet of like what radiation poisoning is or how much actually affects us physically. There was just a lot of open-ended question. It was very, very Wild West. And so in 1961, January 3rd, a reactor blows up and it kills 3 men. And it is still the deadliest nuclear reactor accident in American history. And I never heard about it once as a kid, even though I grew up in this area, even though my dad was in high school at the time in this area when this happened. Like, it was one of those things that happened and everyone's like, well, them's the breaks, and then just sort of like moved on. And at the time I started working on this project there, and since then too, there's just been all this conversation around creating these new generation of nuclear reactors and how they're safer, how they're better, how we understand the technology more. And I wanted to ask a question of, okay, yeah, no doubt that the technology is better than it was 60 years ago, but are we as humans any more responsible than we were 60 years ago in terms of using it? And so that kind of became the genesis for that particular season. Plus, it was a story that was so close to home that I was like, I just want to tell this. So it's my podcast. I get to do what I want.
Yes, you do. Well, that does make a lot more sense. I appreciate that angle of it. Awesome. Well, okay. Even that considered, because some people will consider like Sasquatch and UFO or like aliens kind of in this paranormal or supernatural box. Mm-hmm. And then the nuclear stuff kind of in this other box altogether. Mm-hmm. But that said, across the seasons, you talk about a lot of, you say you have to cover a lot of these pieces of this and you have to talk about this a lot. And it still to this day, it can be very unpopular with some people. Some people still find it a joke, or it makes them upset, or whatever the case may be. Like Grover, have you found in any extent at all of pushback in regards to your career or your other pursuits, anything like that?
I don't know that I have found pushback, but that's partially because I haven't been applying for any jobs. So we'll see what happens if that ever becomes the case. I did get the side eye from some people, just sort of like, this is what you're doing. Like, this is what you're spending your time on. And my feeling on that is it's like, well, you clearly haven't taken the time to actually look at what the podcast is about. You are judging the book by its cover, so to speak. And there's nothing I can do about that. I'm not going to change your mind by arguing with you. All I can say is, hey, listen to the podcast and just see what you think. But I've found a fair amount of validation from a lot of scientists who have reached out and said, I really enjoyed this. I enjoyed the way you talked about it. It was really exciting when I started to hear from, because when I first did the podcast, I wasn't thinking about kids at all. So I aimed the podcast at adults. Just, I was like, people like me who might want to know more about Bigfoot because everybody's talking about it. Like, that was just sort of where I was in my head. But then I started to hear from parents who were listening with their kids. I started to hear from teachers who were using the elements of the podcast in their classroom to talk about evidence and DNA analysis and the scientific method and things like that. And I realized that, I had missed an audience entirely, the children. And B, you know, I was communicating information to people that was useful to them, that helped them understand science as a whole, like the bigger picture of science and how science works and how we think about things. And I kind of stopped caring what the negative Nancys were saying to me. I mean, if you, there's nothing I can do about them, which isn't to say that I still don't get, you know, a little twinge of pain in my heart when I see a nasty review or someone's like, that's dumb. Why? You're not really a journalist if you're reporting on Bigfoot, but whatever.
Oh, that's just like calling, you know, Grover not really a scientist for looking at it. Well, no, actually, right. It's the most scientific thing you can do. I think it's great journalism to look at it. And you were very, just so fair and balanced. Like you said, people just really need to check it out to actually know what it is, what's in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the goal here too was, it's not to make fun of people. I really genuinely wanted to understand what it was about Bigfoot that people found fascinating. Even people, and I spoke to several people who had been out looking for Bigfoot for years and were like, I don't think it's out there. And yet I still want it to be. And I wanted to understand that too. Like, what's happening psychologically, emotionally with something like this? Like, what is it about this creature that appeals to people? So it wasn't just like, let's go out in the woods and look for Bigfoot. It was trying to answer some bigger questions about what it means to be human.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, that easily led, I thank you for the story of how the books came to be, but that easily led to these books. It's The Search for Sasquatch and Is There Anybody Out There? I poured through these. They were just, I know they're written for middle grade ages, but gosh, these were at my level, and it made it so much easier to understand and just really absorb the information. And I don't know, I was just wondering if you could just talk about these a little bit. Am I allowed to show just a little bit of artwork?
Oh yeah, please do.
I wanted to ask about, you know, who did this artwork?
He is awesome. His name is Rafael Nobre. He is Brazilian. And it was the publisher that found him. I'm not sure how they came across him, but When I started, they were sort of, we were talking, going back and forth about who the illustrator might be, because the publisher ultimately has the say in that. And they sort of sent me a couple of different ideas that were coming from him. And I was like, I had been envisioning something sort of like watercolor and like kind of blurry. And when I saw this stuff, I was like, no, this is way better. I love the sort of like block art, the graphic nature of it. Like it just, it fits so well. So he's great. Yeah.
Oh, it's just so much fun to go through these. You know, I don't want to give any of the content away. So I will just say, like, what do you hope folks are going to walk away from each of these with? What kind of information, what is the final like thought that you want them to walk away with?
Yeah, well, it heartens me to hear you say that you felt like it was on your level, because yes, I'm writing it for kids, but I also heard from a fair number of adults who were like, you know, these are concepts that I'm supposed to know because I'm an adult and I went through, you know, education and I learned these big words like DNA and evolution, but, you know, I don't really remember what they are, or I don't really understand the concepts. And this book sort of helped me get those. And I want to say that while I was writing this, I had the same sort of epiphany, because in the podcast, I just sort of like used the words because I was talking to adults and it's like, we all know what this is, right? But when you actually have to write it for kids, you're like, oh, I actually need to put a little bit more of explanation in this. They might not be familiar with this term. And then all of a sudden I'm like, I don't actually know what this means. I'm going to have to like give myself some sort of rudimentary science education in order to be able to explain it to other people. And so I've had a few people say this actually, like, I learned something because that I thought I knew already, and this actually helped me clarify it. So that was a, that's one thing that I'm really glad to hear from both kids and from adults. The other thing is, you know, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but the heart of science is something called the scientific method. And this is essentially like the steps, the basic steps for how to conduct science. Yeah. And the first step of that is, what are you wondering? Ask a question. So there's a question is at the very heart of every investigation in science. And there's no harm in asking a question about something. The harm comes in ignoring what comes after, what you find, what evidence comes up, what information comes after that. If you ignore that and keep asking the same question, or keep saying, well, I don't like this evidence, I'm just going to go with the answer that I want it to be, that's where the problem comes. But the initial wondering, the initial wanting to know and having a question about the world, that's not a problem. And I think sometimes we're too quick to judge people and too quick to say, that's a dumb question. And it's not. It's like, this is something you're wondering, you want to know more about it. And so go out and learn, but, you know, do it in a way that is responsible.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. Absolutely. Can I just say, the Drake equation? You did a wonderful job of explaining it. I still don't understand it. I just can't.
It's hard. I mean, it's like very theoretical ideas. And it's like, we've only begun to like scratch the surface of how we would even begin to figure out what the various factors are that go into that equation. So yeah, it just kind of blows your mind.
It does, but it's fun. So folks, check out those two. They are available. Now you have a new one coming out.
I do.
Well, as you said, it's on pre-order right now. You can pre-order it. Tell us about that. What's it called? What's in it?
So that one will be out in September. And shockingly, the publisher, when I was like getting ready to write the third book, I was like, okay, you know, it's going to follow the podcast. It'll be about nuclear energy. I'm going to tell a slightly different story so I don't scare the kids. They were like, yeah, we don't think nuclear energy is going to be all that interesting to kids. Find something else. And you still have the same deadline. So I sort of cast around and thought about a few things, and I decided to look into magic. So the book is called Do You Believe in Magic? All of the books have a sort of a song reference in them, if you're paying attention. So Do You Believe in Magic? And it's sort of looking at the intersection and the relationship between science and magic. So things like alchemy, you know, we look on that now and it's like, ha ha ha, turning lead into gold, like what idiots. But if you look back at what the process was for trying to figure that out, a lot of what becomes chemistry is founded in alchemy and the things that they learned and they wrote down and recorded and discovered. Similarly, astronomy and astrology, like astrology is the beginning point for what ends up being the science of astronomy. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to sort of look at magic and why it's been such a part of human history for, you know, even since before even any sort of written record, and what it is about it that continues to appeal to us now. Mm-hmm. And so, it kind of goes back into history a little bit. It talks about certain practices. This is kind of crazy for kids, but I get into like the placebo and the nocebo effect, because you can give someone a sugar pill and then they think they're better because they think they've gotten the real medicine. Even sometimes when they know they've gotten the sugar pill, they still get better. That's weird. It feels magical. There is probably some very rational scientific explanation behind it, but we haven't necessarily figured out what that is yet. So yeah. I find that very fascinating. And I also think about into the future. Are they going to look back like 2,000 years in the future and be like, look at what those idiots believed in? You know, we just, science is always changing and altering, and we kind of tend to denigrate what was in the past as being magic or silly or stupid. And yet it's all a foundation that's being built on.
Yeah, yeah. They will say that about us. Trust. Well, that sounds amazing too. I cannot wait till it's available. Do you think you'll do an adjacent thing on the show about it?
Yeah. Don't hold me to this, because I have like 4 different projects going on right now. You might know this about podcasting. It is not the most lucrative industry.
What? No.
Yeah. What? Camera out of 10. Look at all the diamonds. What I would like to do is, I probably won't do a fully produced season as I have in the past. I'll probably do a couple of episodes. But then what I'd like to do is take some of the interviews I did, because when I was doing the book, I interviewed everyone as though I was doing the podcast, just in case. So what I might do is a couple of slightly more produced episodes, and then provide some of the interviews as like a companion to the book, the adult companion to the book. And then, you know, once the podcast industry sort of writes itself and maybe we can figure out how the ads work and all the rest of that, I would like to do additional seasons. But it's just, you know, this is the nice thing about owning it and not being on someone else's schedule, is I can kind of dip in and out and work on it when the time is right.
Right on. Well, I look forward to that as well. You are one busy lady.
Always.
All right, Laura. Well, we are at our final segment here, final questions, final thoughts. So, mm-hmm. And then we'll round it out here. The first final question I've got for you. So the world of Sasquatch is not the world of our grandpappy's Sasquatch. Okay? It's grown so much. It's become so commercialized. There's television shows. There's just so many people involved now, openly involved. It's very, very different. If Grover were alive today, and this is just your speculation from what you know of him, if he were alive today, what do you think he would have to say about the state of the field?
Yeah, that is a good question. I actually have wondered this a few times. You know, he gave a talk back in the 80s where he said, you know, I do not find any romance in the Sasquatch question. Like, there's no, like, you know, I'm not in love with Bigfoot. I just want to find an answer. And move on and get back to, you know, the real work that I've been doing. Now, he said this in the 80s and he was still doing this stuff 20 years later. So methinks the lady doth protest a bit too much. I wonder, because there still isn't the kind of evidence that has convinced scientists that Bigfoot is out there. And I think Grover would still be on that page where he's like, look, we need a body. We need a big piece of a body. Or now DNA didn't really, it existed obviously, but like, we hadn't figured out how to identify it in the way we have now with computers and all the other technology that we have. And so now with the existence of that, I think he would be happy with like some DNA evidence, but I still think he would want the evidence. But my guess is he would also still be looking. I don't think he would have stopped.
Yeah. I think I kind of agree with you on that. I don't think that a lot of these like the four horsemen, the people who just committed their lives to it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. Once you make that commitment, it's kind of hard to walk away from something like that. All right. Next question. This just occurred to me. Sorry, I was distracted there. This just occurred to me. I was wondering, like, because you do a lot of interviews, you get asked a bunch about Grover and the podcast and the books. A lot of these questions get to be a little rote. What is something that you wish somebody would ask you about, or you just love talking about and they rarely do ask you about it?
You know, the thing I find really interesting is sort of the history and the, you know, the geologic record. One of my favorite interviews was with, God, why am I blanking on his name right now? Is the emeritus curator at the American Museum of Natural History. And his name will come back to me after we finish this conversation, because that's how my brain works now.
That's how it works.
But he was also an expert in human evolution, and he sort of walked me through human evolution. And at one point in time, there were 8 different hominid species walking around on the planet at the same time. And I think we tend to think of evolution as being in sort of this straight line, or as like one dies out and then the next one comes up. Like the idea that there were 8 of our somewhat like our closest relatives all coexisting on the planet at once, I find really interesting. And these are the 8 that we have found in the fossil record.
Yeah.
What haven't we found in the fossil record? It is so hard to become a fossil. You have to die under the right conditions, in the right place, at the right time. You have to be covered up by the right kind of material. And then you have to be uncovered in the right place, at the right time, by the right people, and identified for what you are. And the chances of that are so small. There are so many species out there of animals, plants, insects that we never even know if that existed. So in my mind, I have a hard time thinking that Bigfoot exists now, but I mm-hmm. don't necessarily have a problem with thinking that something like Bigfoot might have existed tens of thousands of years ago. And that the stories of Bigfoot have been passed down over generations and like continue to linger with us, even though the creature itself is not necessarily around anymore.
Yeah. I think
it's just cool. I mean, all the things that might have been around. So, yeah.
I know. And I hope someday we do make those discoveries, but you're absolutely right. And I did not know that until, thanks to researching Bigfoot, I did learn that as well, that it's actually, fossils are rare. They're very mm-hmm. rare.
They're very rare.
I want to say that there's only like 200 T-Rex like fossils that have been discovered, like ever. It's a very small number. I can't remember exactly how much it was, but yeah.
Ian Tattersall. That was his name. Dr. Ian Tattersall. I knew it would come back to me.
I'm glad it occurred to you. It was on the tip of my tongue. I was like, I just read this. Go on.
Yeah.
All right. And final question for you. I don't know how brave you're feeling, but
okay. This
being a paranormal podcast, you know, it's for the skeptical believer, but mm-hmm. paranormal nevertheless. Have you, Laura, ever had anything happen to you that you could not explain?
No. And I'm so annoyed by that, because it would make for such better content if it would happen. Like, I've gone on Bigfoot expeditions, and like, I go with all these people who have had like crazy experiences, and we sleep peacefully through the night. I have gone to Roswell and the UFO watchtower and camped out where people have had UFO sightings. And like, the creepiest thing I saw was Starlink, which, to be fair, is pretty fucking creepy. Like a line of like little blinking dots going across the sky. If you haven't mm-hmm. seen it before, even if you know what it is, you're still like, whoa. And if you didn't know what it was, I could see why you'd be like, UFO. I'm a little disappointed.
Oh,
I just gotta
I'm
say
sorry. Yeah, I'm so sorry. No, you know what, that's not a bad problem to have. either. I did see Starlink in person. I had no idea what it was. I was standing on the streets of LA, saw this thing. I thought we were being invaded.
Oh, really?
Yes. It's scary. You don't know what it is.
Yeah. It is a little, it's very weird.
All right. Well, where would you like to direct my audience to learn more, to listen to the show, to buy your books?
Oh, awesome. Okay. So wildthingpodcast.com has all the information about the podcast on it, about all three seasons, and you can get more information about each episode there. You can find the podcast, Wild Thing, on pretty much anywhere you get podcasts. It's available across the spectrum. The books are available on Amazon or at bookshop.org or independent bookstores. Again, widely available. The first one is called The Search for Sasquatch. The second one is called Is There Anybody Out There? And then the third one that'll be out in September is called Do You Believe in Magic? And that one is available for pre-order right now.
Awesome. And to close us out, would you like to leave my audience with any final thoughts, words of wisdom, or a piece of advice?
My final piece of advice is if someone is asking a question and they're genuinely interested in knowing the answer, don't make fun of them. Encourage them to go out and look for answers and see what they can come up with. Maybe help them figure out where to get the right information from if you're working with kids. But let them be questioning. Let them wonder about the world around them, because I think all too quickly we become adults and we stop wondering. We already think we know everything. We think we've made up our minds. And that sense of wonder and fascination with the world is so important to creativity, to discovery, to learning about ourselves, to learning about others. So that is my advice.
Journalist, podcaster, author, Laura Krantz, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me on. This was great.
My humble and sincere thanks to Laura Krantz for appearing on the show. I know a lot of my Squatcher audience out there has already enjoyed listening to Laura's podcast, but if Wild Thing has somehow evaded your pod radar, do yourself the favor and go catch it. Just start at the beginning and you will quickly understand why her show is critically acclaimed and why her adjacent book series is so popular. And learn more about my guest at the links I have provided in the show notes. Please follow the Paranorm Girl podcast on social at Paranorm Girl Pod. You would also be doing me a solid by finding at Paranorm Girl Pod over on YouTube, subscribing, and clicking the notification bell. I do air a visual version of most of these episodes over there every week. So if that is more your speed, join me on YouTube, you guys. That is also how you will be notified whenever I and my co-hosts go live on Beer, Booze, and Boogeymen. As an added incentive, in addition to the great content, once we hit 500, I'm going to do a big giveaway for anyone who has subbed to the channel. That is a wrap for today, but I will see you guys next week. Stay safe, keep the nightlight on, and sleep with one eye open.